Welcome to Conversations with Owens Community College President, Dr. Dion D. Somerville. Welcome to the newest episode of the award-winning Conversations podcast. I'm Dr. Dion D. Somerville. Thank you for listening today. Whether this is your first time with us or if you're a longtime follower, we are so happy that you're joining us as we explore the issues and meet the people who are important to Northwest Ohio and to Owens Community College. Please enjoy our previous episodes and subscribe to Conversations to join us for future episodes. Today, I am so excited to welcome past Regional Growth Partnership Chair Jim Hoffman, a graduate of the University of Toledo, where he earned both bachelor's and master's degrees in business administration. Jim's career in finance spanned more than 40 years. Jim served as president of Key Bank for over 30 years. Northwest Ohio has been lucky to have him bring his talents and knowledge used in his career to many other areas within our community, including the Toledo Regional Chamber of Commerce, United Way of Greater Toledo, the Imagination Station, and more. He has played a key role in civic engagement, fundraising, and overall growth for the area. He is a fierce advocate for development here in Northwest Ohio, from the support of existing businesses to the recruitment of new ones, and he plays a vital role in the strong workforce and community partnerships in Northwest Ohio. We're thrilled that he agreed to join us for a conversation. Hi, Jim, and thank you for being our guest today. Jim, welcome to the Conversations podcast. I am thrilled that you are here joining us today. One of the things that we do for every one of our guests is that we ask them, how did you know that you needed or wanted education beyond high school?
Well, I grew up in a small town. Mm-hmm. And it was a very blue-collar town, and I knew we didn't, as a family, have much money. And so early on, I had to get a job. So I had paper routes, and I also knew that I didn't like to work that hard. And it's kind of like, there's got to be a better way. I saw other people in the community who had, I call them white-collar jobs, mm-hmm. and they had nice houses, nice cars, seemed to be able to enjoy life. And so it wasn't too hard to kind of economically look at a path that said, with an education, I could probably take care of my family mm-hmm. and enjoy life well. And so education was going to be a big piece of that.
So getting up at 3, 4 in the morning throwing papers wasn't your thing?
No, especially when it was a Sunday paper, and it was a really big, thick paper, not like today's. And it had to be there by 8 o'clock in the morning. And when it snowed, it wasn't fun.
It was not fun at all. Now, you went to the University of Toledo. And so tell me how that experience, because you were there for both your bachelor's degree and your MBA. Mm-hmm. How did that kind of help shape your path and what you wanted to do with your career?
Well, you know, everybody's got a unique story about that. And mine was my family was not going to be able to pay for my college education. That was going to be mm-hmm. up to me. So anywhere I could get a scholarship, I was going to go. Mm-hmm. And so I got a scholarship to go to the University of Toledo, and it was to play basketball, and I wanted to be an engineer. After a year of doing that, I didn't want to do either one anymore. It was a very traumatic period for me, because here's two things that I enjoyed, and mm-hmm. I no longer enjoyed doing them. Mm-hmm. And that adversity shaped me in a major kind of a way. So mm-hmm. Life's going to throw you some turns, and it's mm-hmm. how you adjust to them and get better that probably leads to your success. So I found the business school, and that fit my acumen in finance. I was probably pretty good with numbers. I liked the students I was with. I liked the content. And like a lot of things, I met a professor there who was a banking consultant. And so I got to work in bank consulting when I was in college. That's what got me interested in banking and kind of led to the banking side of things for my life.
That's pretty awesome. When you went from your bachelor's to your master's, did you take time out in between, or did you go straight through?
No, my roommate and I actually were doing all this together. We were both finance majors. We both mm-hmm. worked in the consulting company, and we both decided to go into banking. And I'll never forget, we were going to go to Ohio State or Michigan mm-hmm. for our MBA directly. And then we found out both those schools wanted us to take 2 years and wanted us to repeat some classes that we'd already sort of aced at UT. And it's like, well, we don't really want to do that. You know, we want to get out and make some money. Mm-hmm. And that same professor, chairman of the Department of Finance, said, well, why don't you come work for me, be grad assistants, work in my consulting company. And if you do that, and if you start in June, you'll be done in 1 year. So it was like, well, this is great. So
absolutely.
We did it immediately. We were done in 1 year. And then he went to work in banking in New York City. I was going to go there too. And I, for whatever reason, I ended up here in Toledo mainly because of a person I met that ran a bank that interviewed me and convinced me to work for him.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So even back then, you were an advocate for efficient transfer.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it saves a lot of time and a lot of money.
And a lot of heartache, you know. And so, you know, you mentioned that you stayed in Toledo and you worked here, and where you grew up wasn't that far from here. And so how have you seen it evolve over the years, and why is it that you've chosen to call this place home?
Well, let me answer the second part first. I call it home for a couple reasons. First of all, the people that live here are just incredibly nice, friendly, warm people. You don't find that everywhere. And when people come from other parts of the country to Toledo, that's one of the things that just stands out to them. People are welcoming. So you're living with a lot of really nice people. I've still got family in the area. I still have friends. And it's also just a great place to live. The first part of your question is, how has the community changed? And the community quality of place, or quality of life, some people would call it, I think has just continued to get better and better and better. So if you looked over the last 40 years and you said, well, what do you mean? What makes it better? And I'd say, well, look at our institutions. So whether you go to the Art Museum or the Metro Parks or the Zoo or Imagination Station, our Science Center, or even our downtown, they're all fantastic. They're world class. And you don't find that in a lot of big cities, much less mid-sized cities.
Absolutely.
So one of the things that happens here in Toledo is when we decide to do something as a community, we do it exceptionally well. Now, one could argue we should be doing more things, but when we do them, it's incredible. You look at the Mud Hens and the Walleye. Both of them used to be in horrible venues. And here today, world-class venues, sold-out games, affordable. The whole community can come together and celebrate together and take pride. Our universities are better. Owens is better. University of Toledo's better. BG's better. You can get great education. So it's for those reasons, it's kind of like, well, why would I move somewhere else? It used to be you might do it for climate. I would argue today our climate is as good as you can find anywhere. And you think about it. We don't have earthquakes. We don't have fires. We don't have hurricanes. We largely don't have floods. That's happening in a lot of America and upsetting a lot of people's lives. We have an abundance of water here, fresh, clean water. Lots of parts of America, you cannot find that. And that actually leads into economic development. We have so many opportunities to take those assets and make them available to others that I think not only Toledo, but Ohio's best days are still ahead.
It truly is a wonderful place. It's interesting because having lived other parts of the country, there is an ethic of care that people really have in this part of the country where they actually genuinely care about their neighbors, their strangers who they meet, and they want to help. Whatever it is you're doing, they want to be part of.
Yes.
And so that's something that I have found incredibly refreshing in this part of the state, but this part of the country, to where it's not inaccessible to build partnerships or collaborations and community and all of those things. And so I've enjoyed that part of living here as well.
Well, and it's not too big of a city. It's like a big small town or a small big town, however you want to look at it, is if you want to put in just a little bit of effort to build relationships, people welcome that. They aren't put off by it. You find that it's easy to do, and that after you've built relationships, it's easier for those people to help you do things.
Absolutely. I completely agree. So you've worked in finance for several decades.
Yep.
And you talked about how when you found that major, it kind of spoke to you in a way that you're like, okay, I'm good at this. I feel comfortable here. How has that industry changed over the years?
Well, it's been really fun to be part of, I'll call it the banking revolution, or banking modernization maybe would be a good way to describe it. If you look over the last 40 or 50 years ago, go back into the 70s, let's say, and in the 70s, the banks were heavily regulated. And the reason they were heavily regulated is rules that came out of the Depression. In the Depression, the banking industry failed. It was one of the things that made the recession or depression deeper and longer and more painful. And so from a policy standpoint, our government said, we need to protect the banking industry from failure again. And the way you do that is you limit competition. So they would put rules in that would say to the banks, you're not allowed to do any acquisitions. You're not allowed to put up branches unless we approve them. In some states, you weren't allowed to branch at all. You couldn't. You had one office. Illinois was a one-office state. You had one office, and that was it. Seems bizarre to think of something like that.
Especially for a state that big.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But they also would have regulated your products and your pricing. So, for example, if I was running a bank and I paid 3% on savings and the government said that's the maximum, then you couldn't go to another bank that wanted to pay you more. There was a maximum on interest rates. And in the 70s, we started into a deregulatory stance. How do we open this up? How do we allow innovation to happen? And the first thing they did is they allowed people to put up branches. So that's when you would have seen a proliferation of branches. Why? Because it's a lot more convenient for people to come to the branch in their neighborhood than to drive across town. But it also then allowed banks to compete on price. The regulatory rates limit was lifted. But also it was a time where large-scale computers were being developed. This is back when IBM was revolutionizing the world the way NVIDIA and Google and Microsoft are doing today. And large-scale computing gave you the ability to automate processes. And so that happened. And what that led to was an increase in convenience, choice, and innovation for consumers and businesses. So we put up call centers where you could call the bank 24 hours a day. That was revolutionary. 50 years ago, we put in automated teller machines. That was revolutionary. Today, you almost don't need automated teller machines because you don't need cash.
Right.
But you look back, that was a big deal. Home banking was developed, or personal computer banking, where you could go onto your computer. Fast forward to today, you can do all your financial services on your cell phone, your mobile. You can do your investments, you can buy a stock, you can apply for a loan, you can deposit your check. And so to kind of finish that story, consumers and businesses have much more choice, much more competition, much more convenience. And because of that, banks don't need all the branches they built. So you're seeing the closing of branches because there's much less demand. Branches were largely there to go get a loan and to deposit your check. You don't need to do that anymore. So the branches are there today for advice. Now, occasionally you got a problem that needs to be resolved too, but that's kind of the new role for bank branches.
I remember as a kid going to the bank with my parents, and going to the drive-through was a big deal, and you waited in line what felt like an eternity, especially for a little kid, to do whatever. And you don't even need to walk into one for most services anymore unless you choose to, you know, because some people will want that kind of personal experience.
Well, you're bringing back memories, because it used to be all social security checks were mailed to all the retirees. And it happened on the third day of the month. And they all showed up at the bank, and they all wanted to personally deposit it all at the same time. And it was a staffing nightmare, because you had to have, first of all, you had to build the teller stations. You had to have all those tellers there. And then the rest of the month, it would drop off till payday came. And in the 70s, you would have gotten a personal payroll check. Well, you got to take it to the bank to deposit it. So when all that got automated and direct deposit came along, that was probably the single biggest change for the better for consumers.
Well, I remember that my dad still worked at the post office. And so all of those, you know, taxes, tax return, to all of those times, I remember being incredibly busy for the same reasons. So you and I met because you were the chair of Regional Growth Partnership. And Regional Growth Partnership has a very proud history. You actually helped create that group a little more than 20 years ago. But for our listeners who may not know, RGP really has had a leading role in Northwest Ohio for economic development, particularly business retention and expansion. It has a partnership with Jobs Ohio. Can you talk a little bit about RGP, kind of the vision for it and why it's still thriving today, but also what makes this area attractive to businesses? And we talked about that a little bit with the natural resources, but could you expand on that a little?
Yeah, so the Regional Growth Partnership was started 20 or 25 years ago. There was an economic development organization. It was funded through a tax levy, and because of that, it had all kinds of politics around it. It was hard to do things confidentially, and also it was hard to do it regionally. You know, we need to think regionally, not home county. But when your tax levy comes from Lucas County, Lucas County rightfully wants to see you working on Lucas County stuff. As a leader, I wanted to see economic development that was regionally focused. How do we win in Findlay? How do we win in Defiance? How do we win in Bowling Green? It can't be just about Toledo. We should help everybody rise. So we created the RGP, and it's 100% privately funded. So it's businesses who care about economic development who are funding this. And its job is to do the two things you described. One is to attract businesses to put new operations into this market to provide high-quality jobs. Secondly, is to work with businesses that are already here so that we retain them and help them expand. So what it takes is basically sales teams who go out and talk to people to try to understand what are their opportunities, what are their needs, and then how do we come up with solutions for them that really fit. So if you look over that last 20 years, we average about 5,000 new jobs a year. We average about $2 billion of capital improvements a year, so new plants being built. Sometimes the projects are $2 billion by themselves. So if you looked at the tallest building in Northwest Ohio is the Cleveland Cliffs briquetting facility at the port, that big tall thing. That's a $1 billion plant. If you went to North Star Blue Scope Steel out in Delta, huge, brand new, high-tech steel plant with two other steel processing plants around that, that was probably $1.5 billion. So these are mega kind of projects. The one that I would say we could be most proud of would be the journey that First Solar has taken. First Solar was started by a university professor at University of Toledo, along with a local entrepreneur who both had glass histories. And this entrepreneur really wanted to sort of solve the energy puzzle. How do we provide energy without burning carbon? And this was 25, 30 years ago that this person wanted to do that. So they raised some money locally from investors and spent it all, weren't getting anywhere, did another round. And they advanced this thing, but eventually they ended up selling it to Sam Walton's son, who pumped $200 million into finishing it off, which he did, creating First Solar. First Solar, even though their headquarters is in Arizona, the bulk of their operations are here. I can't even tell you how many million square feet are in their manufacturing facilities, but this year we helped them with their new R&D facility. So it's got 280 high-tech R&D people working here in our market, doing cutting-edge research, making that solar more and more competitive, efficient, and sustainable. Creating jobs like that, which help elevate our community, is really why the RGP is here.
We had the plant manager of First Solar as one of our podcast guests earlier this year, and we're very fortunate because he also serves on our foundation board of directors. And as far as companies go, I mean, literally they are almost in walking distance from our Perrysburg campus. And so it really has been a unique relationship. But to your point, it's like the sense of pride you have of knowing how far-reaching First Solar's impacts are. And you mentioned the glass industry, and Toledo very clearly is the glass capital of the world and has a lot of history there. But RGP has also been very integral in the Northwest Ohio Innovation Consortium's Glass Center of Excellence. Mm-hmm. And so sounds very similar to where, you know, here you have industry and entrepreneurs and folks wanting to drive innovation. Can you talk a little bit about why that project was so important to RGP?
Yeah, it was really interesting. If you went back 2 years ago, there was federal innovation grant money available. And as a community, and it was targeted towards communities like Toledo, not the three C's, but the people like us. And we didn't even know what an innovation hub was, but it was like, oh my gosh, this is so much money. You're going to get $50 to $100 million to target into your industry. There was actually an article that came out that ranked Toledo like number one city that might want to get one of these. So it's like, well, we at least should apply. And I'm looking around like, well, who's going to do all this? And it's like, well, there's nobody else. So at an RGP meeting, we said, we think we ought to get organized. We're going to have to spend some money. We might have to hire a lobbyist. But who else but us? And they said, sure, let's go ahead and do it. So that was kind of the start. We engaged others in the community. And I forget who told us. It might have been the lieutenant governor. It was the lieutenant governor and the head of Jobs Ohio. They said, you know, basically, if you're going to do this, focus on glass. That's, you have more technology smarts around glass, and you can include solar, but don't go out and try and say you're a software development hub or that you know there's something else that somebody else is doing. Focus on what you're good at and where you have core strengths. So we said, well, let's do glass and solar. We invite the glass companies in, try to explain to them what this is about, and they're kind of scratching their heads because they not only have never heard of it, but they don't work together. These glass companies are all in their own silos. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of good because they don't compete on any products. So when we got them together, they said, well, yeah, you know, we all do melt sand. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have an oven. It all starts with melting this stuff. Now we make a different product. But yeah, we should be working together because we have common problems. So we didn't get the federal grant, but then the state put up Innovation Hub money. It's one of the governor and lieutenant governor's big initiatives. And it was once again designed for cities like Toledo. And we had a running start because mm-hmm. we had assembled everybody. We got them excited. So we pivoted and went towards the state grant. And I couldn't be prouder of the application that we gave them. I'll never forget, we had to go through a technical review with the Department of Development at the state. And they had five technical experts from across the country on the other end of the line mm-hmm. that were going to grill us on what we're doing to figure out if we know what we're doing, what we're talking about, how well we're organized. And we just blew their socks off. It was incredibly well done. And because of that, when the state decided to start making these awards, Toledo was chosen as the first one in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And when I asked them, why did you choose us? And they said, you were the best organized. You had thought this through. You knew what you were going to do. Those other cities like Dayton and Akron and Canton and others, they've got some work to do to get to where you're at. And it was kind of like, wow. Mm-hmm. Once again, when we decide to do something, we do it really, really well. And so we've hired our exec director. We've organized five major R&D projects in the Glass Innovation Hub. The universities invested into this. Owens is participating along with UT and BG. And we have the four glass companies were First Solar, five major projects identified, and over the next 3 to 4 years, they're going to just leapfrog in these technology areas designed to make them globally competitive and globally sustainable for as long as possible.
It's pretty incredible. And you never want to miss out on anything, but it really seems as though the experience of not getting the federal grant made us hone our skills and the application that much more.
Yep.
When it came to the state application.
Well, I think the reason we didn't get the federal one was we weren't even in existence. Akron actually won. They got $50 million from the feds because they have a polymer institute down there. They've been doing this for 10 or 15 years. They have a track record. They look a lot more believable than us saying, here, look at all the good things we're going to do. And, oh, by the way, we haven't even hired anybody yet. So I get why we didn't do it. It was a blessing because we're off and going and flying.
It's pretty incredible. And one of the things that I'm hopeful for is that, you know, we have the Glass Center of Excellence, but there's almost now a template for how we can come together around some of the bigger issues mm-hmm. that we might want to be able to solve, or not even necessarily solving issues, but how do we kind of continue to push forward and what's next for the region? And how do we delve deeper and not just play around the edges?
So the community is asking that question right now. So when we're in the middle of trying to envision what are the big initiatives we ought to try and tackle as a community. I mean, mm-hmm. most communities move forward by having a leadership group of businesses and public sector and educational institutions who develop a community agenda and then try to make it happen. So over the years, we used to have a thing in Toledo called the Committee 100 that did that. And then, oh, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, we had the 22nd Century Committee. And 22nd Century Committee was mainly focused on downtown. They came up with, I think, six or seven major things to do in the downtown. And because they did a plan and they got people organized, I think it resulted in almost $1 billion in investment in our downtown. We're doing a park on the riverfront that the Metro Parks is doing that is the envy of Ohio and the United States, honestly, to take both sides of the river and make it all incredible parkland with all kinds of activities accessible to everyone is just unbelievable. A new convention center, new streetscaping. I mean, you can go on and on and on, but it shows the power of getting organized. So we're in the middle of doing that right now. We have a, so I'll call it a pilot plan of maybe 10 initiatives, and they're about improving quality of place. So how do we continue downtown development? How do we encourage our cultural and education institutions to elevate themselves? How do we create more activities for people to enjoy their lives? How do we do economic development better? There's a great opportunity to try to attract and develop more white-collar jobs. RGP has done an incredible job, but I would say 80, 90% of it's blue-collar jobs. Nothing wrong with that. These are great jobs. But if you do blue collar alone and don't focus on white collar, you're missing a huge opportunity. So we're trying to pivot around that right now. We're also trying to re-energize our innovation and commercialization infrastructure. We've taken a couple swings at that over the years. And in the way it works is you get people together, they get focused on some things, you run it out. You do a lot of good things, and then 10 years later, the players change or the economics change, and you got to redo it again. And that's kind of where we're at. Jefferson Center would be a good example of an entrepreneurial innovation center, wonderful asset, but it's vacant in downtown Toledo. It's a huge opportunity to make some really good things happen. So that's just an example of the kind of thing we could take on. And I think by year end, we'll probably have this figured out. We will have assembled a leadership group. We'll kind of assign the responsibilities of who ought to be on the teams. And you'd be happy to hear that education is one of those pillars. If you took a look at Lucas County's education statistics, they're alarming. We have one of the lowest high school graduation rates, not only of current people, but of people who live here. We have low community college and four-year college graduated degreed people. Same thing with certificates. And if you have an area that's undereducated, it's going to underperform economically. Your people are not going to earn as much as others. And it's going to be hard to do things. And what's going to happen is you're going to have more and more poverty. And poverty creates umpteen problems beyond just being poor. It tends to create healthcare problems, education problems, crime problems, all kinds of problems. And if you can do something about poverty, you can improve a lot of outcomes. But until you really deal with that, and poverty improvement starts with education, training, but then also having high-paying jobs for those people. So focusing on that, it's kind of interesting. I read a book that talked about healthcare improvement around the world. And if you looked at the countries where healthcare measured by your longevity has improved the most, it's not the United States and Europe and all that. It's all these developing countries, and it's China. And why is that? Well, it's because you improve the standard of living. People eat better. People can afford to go to the doctor. People have transportation. So if you can focus on the economics, you can impact so many things. And at the core of that, it is about getting a good education. So how do we do that? Well, we need educational experts like yourself engaged. But it probably starts with a pre-K education system in Lucas County. We're the only significantly sized city in Ohio that doesn't have a publicly funded pre-K program.
That's a crime.
That's something we should fix.
You're preaching the Owens gospel here. We talk a lot about how there's a relationship between educational outcomes and life outcomes, be it earnings, be it health, crime, all of those things. And so for us, that's where we believe so much in those partnerships, because while it's not our role to create a pre-K, we have early childhood education and we can partner with people, and our students can, you know, be involved in lab school environments. I mean, there's so many things that as each of us bring our collective expertise to be able to solve those issues, it makes us better as a community overall. As you think about a lot of the statistics, either the ones that come from census, from Bureau of Labor Statistics, even one of our congresspeople had their office go back and do some research. It's not a surprise the challenges that we have when you look at how these things line up. And I think that as you you know, hear the conversation, you know, locally as well as nationally about do you actually need education beyond high school? I don't know how you look at those statistics that are enduring over decades and not believe that you need education. I mean, it just makes absolute sense that when you look at patterns like that, that education is meaningful in how we help change so many things. One of the things that I know has been an initiative of RGP and as well as other areas throughout the state and Jobs Ohio has been looking at educational attainment, number of degrees, what kind of degrees. You mentioned the white collar. A lot of, depending on what the jobs are, because I think some of those definitions are morphing a little bit. But when you look at them, all of them require something beyond high school. And so as we talk about community colleges, talk to me a little bit about your philosophy on the interrelatedness between community colleges and economic development.
Well, I think community colleges are really well positioned to listen to the market on what is the demand out there for what kind of skills. And also, how do you anticipate skills that are going to be required in the future? So if you take the workforce today, some need training, some need retraining. As technology changes all these jobs, it's only going to make training, education more important, not less important. And the natural demand is going to come from the businesses that are going to want to employ these people. So I think Owens does a good job of trying to connect with large employers to try and listen and learn to what those needs are. When we go out to do economic development, education is one of the questions that's always asked. I mean, they first of all want to know, do you have the workforce for me to hire? Because if you don't, they're not coming. I mean, it just makes sense. And that's two things. One is, do you have enough unemployed people, or are there enough people in the area who could commute? And here's the skills I'm looking for, and do they have them or don't they? For example, if an AI company wanted to come to Toledo, I would say AI is not a robust curriculum in our colleges yet. We have some, but compared to Silicon Valley, Ann Arbor with the University of Michigan, or even Research Triangle down in North Carolina, there are robust AI degree kind of programs there. So they're kind of ahead of us. So how do we pick the other things, okay? Mm-hmm. And when we look at our resources, one of the things that we've done on the White Collar Initiative is looked at all the colleges within an hour of Toledo as to what kind of training and degrees do they create, because that's what we have to sell to people. And then second of all, if we took a look at the people who are working today within an hour of Toledo, what kind of jobs are they in today? And that's really what we're selling to somebody. So if Google wants to come here and consider a data center campus, if they did one data center, they might need 30, 35 people. If they did 7 or 8 buildings, they might need 150 to 200 people. Where are you going to find those skilled people? And the truth of the matter is, within an hour of Toledo, there are all kinds of people with those skills. Now, if you just did Lucas County, might not be enough. But when you include Southeast Michigan in our market, which is absolutely part of our market, there's an incredible amount of degreed technical people within an hour of Toledo. And would they commute to Toledo or move to Toledo? Absolutely, for the right job. Mm-hmm. And people will say, oh, they won't come here. And it's kind of like, well, you know what?
They already do.
First Solar's got 280 R&D people. They didn't come from Toledo. They love living here. So it's kind of like opening up the box a little bit, thinking a little broader, and realizing you have a lot more assets to sell to people than you had ever thought.
It's pretty amazing when you think through it. And even where we are, where we're located just south of Toledo proper, we employ people from Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
And it makes sense in a border community to not think so provincially at the state line, which, you know, it has implications, taxes and whatever else, but it's kind of artificial. If you look at it totally as a barrier, how is it that you embrace your entire region?
Well, it's kind of funny. You reminded me of my job at the bank, and I would go out and call on companies and try and get them to bank with us. And I'd drive out to Defiance and Findlay and Lima and Sandusky and do all this stuff. I didn't drive to Ann Arbor hardly ever, and it was closer.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, What am I thinking? Well, first of all, I don't know anybody in Ann Arbor. I know a few, but not enough. Where Northwest Ohio just feels so comfortable to everybody. Mm-hmm. And so we, honest God, we start calling in these little towns in Michigan. We picked up all kinds of mm-hmm. good business because we had to realize they're in our market.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I drive to Ann Arbor just to go to Trader Joe's.
Well, heck yeah. Why not?
There's one important thing up there. So one of the things that really has impressed me about your career is that you think beyond your role. Like we've spent all this time talking really about regional growth partnership and everything, but that wasn't your primary career. Your career was being bank president. Yet you have this vision to think beyond, you know, what your individual role may be. You're looking at the community. You're looking at economic development. And yeah, there's an interrelatedness there, and we've talked a little bit about that. But you've also been involved in the Toledo Regional Chamber of Commerce. You were involved in getting the Imagination Station up and going. And so talk to me about what about those initiatives or those opportunities made you say, you know what, I'm a banker, but I think it's really important that our young people have a science center.
Well, it probably goes back to grade school, high school, where, you know, you started getting involved in service organizations. You know, your church was reaching out and trying to help people, so you probably got a taste of it kind of there. Mm-hmm. When I got into college, I had an opportunity to be leader of a couple things. I was in student government, head of my fraternity, and president of the finance club, whatever. And so these are things, I mean, you didn't have to do them to get a degree, but I know you were learning and growing, and they were interesting. Mm-hmm. And I guess leadership is just something I've always enjoyed. You know, not everybody enjoys it. And when I got into banking, I had all kinds of role models. I mean, everybody at the bank was on a board of something, mm-hmm. and the president of the bank was on all the important boards. And so they set this example of, well, this is what we do at the bank. We're all involved. You know, even in those days, I mean, the Andersons would have had 10, 15, 20 people involved in boards. Owens, Illinois, mm-hmm. and all the other banks, too. So it was like part of the community was pitching in and volunteering. So I saw that. And then, you know, I got to spend a lot of time with, like, the CEOs of my bank when they were doing things in the community. So I got to see how people would do that. And then you just had relationships in town with other leaders. I'll never forget, like, Dick Anderson was one I was really close with, and mm-hmm. we just liked each other, and he'd call me up and ask me to help out on something. You couldn't say no to him. He was doing so much already that it's kind of like, well, how do you say no to Dick? Well, you couldn't. And then you get involved, and, you know, it might be a huge problem. You get in the middle of it and go, oh, my God, why did I get into this? It's a mess. I don't know if I'll ever figure it out. And you always figure it out. I don't know how it happens, but it's kind of like good people working together usually end up with a decent conclusion. And then later in your career, you kind of realize, well, you now are one of those old leaders that knows how to do things, and you should be helping the young ones learn how to do this. And so that's kind of the phase I'm in now, is when I retired from the bank, I still have a lot of connections. I still enjoy helping others. And so it's kind of like, well, if the current leadership is willing to have me around, I'm glad to help them. I don't want to get in their way. But the truth of the matter is, it's a learning process. We have a lot of new leaders in town, some of which haven't had the background that I've got. So whether it be me, there's other leaders like myself in town that are working to kind of bridge this change in leadership that we've got going. And the good thing is, I don't have a regular job where I got to run a bank, so I have the time, it's easier, and it's more relaxing. And I'm kind of amazed at some of the things we're getting done now, so I'm optimistic.
There's a lot that's happening right now, although I am amazed that even in retirement, you still enjoy 7:30 a.m. board meetings.
I don't. No, I really don't. I had one yesterday and today, and it's going to kill me. It's like they should outlaw 7. I used to be the one who wanted 7:30 meetings when I was working. And, in fact, the other day at the RGP, they were thinking of moving our executive meetings till mm-hmm. noon. And they said, well, why were we having them at 7:30? And the one guy said, because you said that's when they would be. It's 20 years ago. And I was like, well, I hate them. So good question.
So as you think through all the work that RGP has done, what are you most proud of?
That we were able to convince a whole bunch of businesses to invest a lot of money in trying to make our community better on the economic development front. And they not only gave us their money, but they participated on the board, and that it's been able to sustain itself for so long. It's not easy in the nonprofit world. It's not like it's a straight path to success. It has a lot of twists and turns and ups and downs, and in some of those, money goes away, leadership goes away, a big problem develops, and so to have a sustainable, successful one. And what's nice about RGP is we're part of a network, the Jobs Ohio Network. We get about $2 million a year from the state of Ohio to help us do this really well, but we get held accountable for results, and we get measured against the other seven regions in Ohio. So when we look at Dayton and Akron and Cleveland and Columbus and Cincinnati, we're benchmarked against them. And so we know whether we're performing or not. And what's really cool about the RGP, we rank in the top third against our peers year after year after year. And it's kind of like, that's pretty darn good. So it's worked really well.
Dean Mosky always says we're punching above our weight.
I think so. Yeah. Yep.
So as we think about your path educationally to a career in finance and banking, what advice would you offer a student who's considering that as a career opportunity?
Well, you don't always have to know what it is you exactly want to do when you start down this path. But you should probably find the things you're good at and the things that you enjoy. You spend a lot of time working, and if it doesn't fit your aptitude and your attitude, it's probably not going to be very enjoyable. My work career was 99% enjoyable. And I look forward to going to work. And I have relatives, when I tell them that, they just shake their head like, that can't be true. I hated my job. Well, yeah, you were at the plant doing the same thing with no variety and no promotion. And I get that. But it's kind of like there's so many interesting things to do, but find the things that you might really enjoy. But also realize that getting your degree is just the start of your education. You want to be as curious as possible. You want to embrace change, especially technological change. Mm-hmm. And that requires lifelong learning. And it starts inside you. If you aren't motivated to continually learn and get better, then you won't, okay? Mm-hmm. And there's no one else out there. Don't expect your employer to tell you exactly what to do. This is really up to you. So whether it's reading books or taking classes or just learning technology, you know, I'm older now. So when new technology comes out, it isn't like it's automatic like it is for my kids, let's say. But you got to force yourself to stay up on this stuff. And if you do, your life is richer and better. And it keeps your mind sharp and you productive for as long as you possibly can. But be ambitious, be hardworking, and be the kind of person that wants to help other people. That's really all sales is. And most jobs, you've got to convince other people about things. And you'll get people to help you do things if you think of them first. Mm-hmm. What are they trying to accomplish? What are their needs? How could I help them? If you do that, you're creating a relationship, and you'll probably get lots of help doing things.
Okay. You're retired.
Yeah.
What are you looking forward to that does not involve working?
Well, I like to fish. I do a little bit of golf, so it creates more time to do that. It's nice not to have all these things on your mind. So one of the things I didn't want to do is find a second career or a second job to do, because you'll do it, you'll be successful at it, but it's kind of like you've just spent 40 or 50 years doing that. Why would you want to keep doing that? Well, one thing is, if you really, really enjoy it, mm-hmm. and your family likes it, no, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. The old idea of retiring so you could do nothing made a lot of sense when these were all hard jobs, mm-hmm. and your body wore out, and you died by the time you were 65 or 70. Yeah. Early retirement made a lot of sense. you retire early now, and it's like, what are you going to do with the next 30 or 40 years of your life? And second of all, you can have a lot of fun being productive.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with making money and being more financially secure and being able to be charitable. And you know, so why not do things like that? So I think this whole thing of aging, people are going to live, they're already living so much longer. They're in such better physical shape, and I think generally in better mental shape. But you can go backwards rather than forwards if you let all that atrophy. So part of it is I want to stay engaged. I'm helping a guy start an AI company. I'm on two private company boards where it causes me to have to think and still use my business skills. But the nice thing is they're part-time now.
And you get to decide.
Exactly.
You get to decide all of it.
Yep. And you have the time, too, that if you spontaneously want to do something. If I decide I want to go fishing tomorrow, I can probably go fishing tomorrow. Where when I was working at the bank, I needed to plan it out weeks ahead of time. And that freedom's really nice. I just compliment Owens. You're a tremendous asset to our region. You help a lot of people that maybe didn't excel in high school, get a second chance at education, and you work really hard. And same thing with people out in the business world who need a new start. That's as important as, you know, taking kids and just having this lifelong learning path. There's a lot of people that get sideways and they need help, and you guys do a great job.
Thank you. No, we believe very much in our mission and understand that we're here for everybody, regardless of what your experience may have been prior to.
Tried to keep it affordable. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why, you know, when people question college degrees today, a lot of times it's a statement about the cost. You know, it's like all that money to do what? And it's kind of like, yeah, it's a valid question. It's not that it wouldn't pay off, but it's also like, boy, you know, Owens is affordable. Most of our four-year state schools are pretty affordable. When you start getting to private college, it's really, really expensive. And in some cases, maybe wasn't a great investment for people. So I think it's a valid question to ask, but I think you guys are perfectly situated.
Jim, this has been an absolute pleasure having you on the Conversations podcast. Our conversation really has tied into so many of the themes that not only that you and I have talked about, but, you know, the Innovation Consortium, you know, everything. And it really highlights the partnership that I think we have. We thank you very much for your support of Owens Community College and for all that you're doing to ensure the economic health of our region for now and into the future. And so much appreciated and enjoyed having you on Conversations.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, Dion.
Thank you.
Jim, thank you so much for being with us. I'm always impressed with your drive to see continued growth and positive change in the region. We're so lucky to have you, and thank you to all of our listeners. Please remember to subscribe and join us for future conversations. Until next time, take care.